Morning. Please be seated, everyone. And we'll go ahead and call the first case, which is case number 62654. We have Kristen Henson versus Howard Henson. Again, on the attorneys, Mr. Torvinen representing the appellant, Mr. Sumter, the respondent. Counsel, before we proceed, Justice Perger is not here today, but he will be participating in the decision of this case in the oral argument. Justice Hardis, he is recused from participating in the case. Okay, so we have six justices. So, Mr. Torvinen, you may proceed. And would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal? I'm sorry, how much? Okay.
May it please the court. I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellant, Kristen Henson. My name is Todd L. Torvinen, practice law in Reno. I woke up this morning and changed my oral argument. Might be a dangerous thing to do, but when I started thinking about pensions, this court has taken up the idea of pensions, the notion of pensions and issues with pensions, especially PERS pensions, lots of times. And the reason pensions are so vexatious to folks are because pensions create a second dimension, right? In the law, we do things at fixed points in time. Value, events are all fixed. A pension is not. It adds a second dimension, time. Hence the time rule, the Gemma case. And that leads me to what I believe the briefs say and what the court wants to hear about. There were two main assignments of error. One, did the trial court have the jurisdiction to enter the second quadro in this matter, effectively taking a survivorship benefit away from my client? And two, was it error to not grant a CERTIC judgment? Okay, but really, is it okay if I leave the lectern or do I need to stay here?
Well, we just need to get you on the microphone. Okay. So if you could, but you're welcome to point to the...
Okay.
Counsel, you're welcome to get up and move around if you want to get a better view of what opposing counsel's referring to.
Okay, so, but here's what happened here. I mean, the CERTIC judgment was denied, and this is a period of time. Howard Henson turned 65 in 2003 and did retire. Then he waited 11 years. He's going to be 76. This pension went into the pay mode after the notice of appeal was filed in about November 2013. But that was denied. There was a stream of payments over time that was denied. Okay? This part is, I say, end participant. That means the death of the participant. And after that is where the survivor takes over. So my client had that taken away from her, okay? So what she's left with now, and this gets to the assignment of error, she's left with a little slice of time and right at the end of the actual bell curve, the actuarial bell curve for Howard Henson. That's all she's left with. And I would submit to you that that is not what Judge Jordan intended. I would submit to you that the decision in order from 1995 that the briefs referred to multiple times, what that did is it made an unequal distribution. Why did it make an unequal distribution? Well, there were a number of reasons cited. One, Dr. Henson ceased his medical practice, what was considered to be, and it's in the decision in order, a medical practice with substantial value shortly after filing for divorce, about 3 months after. 5 months after filing for divorce, he went to work for the state at the Nevada Mental Health Institute as a psychiatrist. And then, and this is referenced in the decision in order too, apparently because he quit his medical practice, he forfeited an interest in a medical building. And finally, on the morning of trial, he filed for bankruptcy. Now, you know, Judge Jordan didn't find anything, any scienter or bad faith, but let me tell you something. When that happened at trial and the Judge Jordan made an unequal distribution, this is my argument. I think you can read into that because he made an unequal distribution because a substantial part of the marital estate had been stripped of value. He did that. He made that unequal distribution. And as part of that, it's consistent that an option to pension was submitted to the court, and Judge Jordan signed that. And it's consistent with the divorce decree. Which comes to the assignment of error. The question here, as I thought about this, the question is twofold. Is a quadro, is it simply a collection device like a wage assignment or a garnishment, in which case you don't need notice? Is a quadro more than that? And does a quadro change the terms of the divorce decree? That's the question. Does it change the terms of the divorce decree? If it changes the terms of the divorce decree, then the quadro would be either, you know, the second quadro, if the second quadro done in this case changed the terms of the divorce decree, what you're really doing is changing a divorce decree, and therefore that's a 60B matter. Right? You're modifying the divorce decree. We can't do that after somebody gets divorced under, 125-1506. Can't do it. That's the question. What is a quadro? And I'm submitting to you that the quadro was entered in this case was correct, and it was in line with what Judge Jordan ordered. What Judge Peck did, what the lower court did, was they took a property interest away from my client. This part of the timeline. They took a property interest away from my client. And that property interest, when it was initially granted to her in 1999, was consistent with the divorce decree.
Mr. Turbini, let me ask you a couple questions, maybe for background the court, and for Mr. Sompter can address this as well. Normally, aren't quadros done simultaneous with the decree of the divorce? Isn't that the normal procedure?
I would say, I've done a lot of this stuff. Usually they are, but boy, there's that 10, 20, 30% that aren't done. Okay. For whatever reason, for several years.
Okay. Also, and this might be a collateral issue, but does PERS recognize quadros and decrees as far as the non-employee on it? What's their address? Because I've heard just episodically in the past that PERS won't recognize the orders entered in quadros as to the non-government employee, that it has to be done differently. Is that true or not? What's your
non-government, you mean the alternate payee?
Yeah,
is that what you're saying to me?
Correct, yes. If the husband's the government employee and the wife is not, and there's a divorce and a quadro, that the PERS may not recognize the pension division here as it has to be done in a different manner through...
I have not found that be the case.
Okay.
Found is if there's a statute that says what do you have to comply with to get a quadro entered, if you follow the statute, they do it. It's their roadmap. And I think people that get sideways with PERS don't follow the statute. That's my experience.
Okay.
Where was that? Oh, okay, so what is this? Is it a 60B collateral attack or a change of the decree? Or is it something that flows from the decree? That's the question. And that's what the cases in the briefs talk about. Does it flow from the decree or does it change the decree? And I have one additional case I found. It's called Wells versus Wells at 998 Southwest 2nd 165. It's a Missouri appellate case, and that's the question. They were monkeying with, I don't know if that's a legal term, monkeying with the beneficiary designations, and what they were doing, was it in line with the divorce decree or was it not? That's the question, and it's similar to what happened in this case, and so I thought I'd point that out to you. And also the issue, this wasn't pointed out in the briefs, I couldn't see it, Kramer versus Kramer, which says, you can't go back after 3 years and change the distribution schedule of the property, and the same issue. You can't go back and change what the divorce decree ordered, right? And it's the same issue with the quadro.
That's Counsel, there was a 1999 order of the court that indicated retention of jurisdiction, and it set out some things.
Yes.
Is this an accord, or is this...
That's a good question, and I'm glad you asked that. As I did the research and I looked through this, and I think the quadro is consistent with this. The court maintains jurisdictions to enter additional or amended quadros consistent with this order. And that is left in there for a ministerial act, right? Something could change a little bit, something around the margins, maybe the law changes a little bit. But if you're changing the deal, the original deal between the parties, how can that possibly apply? Then you're going back and running smack dab into what the divorce decree ordered. And that's a collateral attack. One more thing, I'm getting short of time here, but the briefs are loaded with language about, you know, did Dr. Hansen, was he tardy in fixing the quadro? And he waited first. He found out in 2004, brought up in 2006, didn't file his motion until 2011. And the questionnaire for that, and none of the briefs say that, I don't think, is whether the quadro that was entered, whether it was a void order, right? Because the two cases that are cited to you are what, the Harrison Living Trust and Deal versus Baines, right? The questionnaire, whether a subsequent order, that subsequent order is, if it's void, and in both those cases there was not notice, one was a trust case, no notice, and the other was I think it was a default that was entered after the five-year rule, no notice. And the question, in both of those cases, one case was 18 months and the other case was 2 years, the question was whether the person who tried to set that aside acted reasonably, even if it was a void order. And you folks found in those cases that 18 months and 2 years was too long.
Well, you phrase it as void. Is it possible it could be considered voidable where action has to be taken?
Yes, you could. I can't. I mean, I have to. But the way this was briefed and the way I looked at that, the question is void. I'm arguing to you that this quadro was not void. It was not voidable because it was completely consistent with what the court ordered initially under the decree of divorce. That's my argument. And you'll hear from opposing counsel on the other side.
You begin with Mr. Hansen being 65 at a certain point. How much time did he have in his PERS account at the time of the divorce?
That's a good question. I was going to cover that. Under the strict time rule, which is time in the plan during marriage over total time in the plan, it's 10.0135 years. That was reduced, and you could see that through the respondent's brief, to 5.3 years if you use service credits during the marriage over total service credits. And that leads me to my next the point about the Surdick case. The judge denied Surdick relief. And the last paragraph of the order, she said you used the wrong numbers. Well, you know, we used the numbers from the benefit statement that said there was 10.0135 years of service.
Well, the way I understand it, you don't vest till you do 5 years,
right?
But you get 2.5%,
right?
Or I think it's now 2.67. Right. But once you hit the 5 years, that vests, and then you get the additional time, correct?
Right. And whether or not you're vested, you still have a community interest, right? Whether or not vested, we know that. I can't remember the name of the case. But and then you're going to hear about NRS 286-676-1B. That's in the briefs. I've got to mention this. The judge's error here when she entered this quadro is that statute says at death, in order to have an option two beneficiary at death, you got to have 15 years of service at death. She grafted a requirement that there be 15 years of community service on top of that. And the other thing is that statute has a metaphysical fiction in it. What it says is, nobody's read the last part of that statute, what it says there's a presumption or assumption that the employee dies immediately after retiring, and just before retiring, they make their option election. Everything's shoved up to the end, i.e. the wait-and-see approach. That's what that does. And that was not briefed in the case. As far as Surdick is concerned, and I have 2 minutes, as far as Surdick is concerned, I just want to point out for you the Headland case. It was not briefed. Nobody mentioned the Headland case. And the Headland case, which was decided in 2009, I'm going to read right out of it. It doesn't refer to the Surdick case, but let me tell you, this is what it says. Quote, third to last paragraph, Noreen and the district court were correct in assuming Noreen could elect her share of Vincent's PERS benefits when Vincent was first eligible to retire, i.e. Surdick.
Was Headland an opinion?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
First it was unpublished, then became published.
Right.
Okay. And the other thing Headland holds is that NRS 125-155 doesn't apply. That's a red herring to this case. At any rate, the issue of should the court have ordered a hearing, I'd just like to point you to, nobody briefed these or mentioned them, Ogawa. which is 221 Pacific 3rd, 699, and Blanco versus Blanco. And both of those are divorce cases. One is a sort of a half forfeiture because of not following discovery rules. The other one was a ordering that a hearing is required where their property is in dispute. But there are substantial factual issues in this case, and a hearing was not ordered. Lastly, and I was hoping I'd have time for this, I have 36 seconds. There's the way forward. All the mischief is caused because PERS, you can't do two measuring lives like you can under ERISA. Under ERISA, you can carve out a life for the alternative beneficiary, you can carve out a life for the participant, and they both go their own way. You can only have one beneficiary. That is the problem. And so we have these fights over beneficiary status. And the legislature hasn't changed that. But there is a way forward. Our friend Marshall Willick, who's explained this in the book or in his article, Wacky World of Pensions, you can, if you find that, I got to stop.
Didn't finish your thought.
Okay. If you find, now that this thing's in the pay mode and Mimi Henson, Howard Henson's current wife, now, there was all this discussion about who's an indispensable party. Is it PERS? I didn't get any of that. But what I do get now is Mimi Henson is an indispensable party. Because under this timeline, she's holding part of my client's property interest.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Trevino.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Would you mind taking that down? And we'll go ahead, unless counsel can refer to it if he wishes to.
Would you like
to?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Sumter? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chief Justice and Honorable Justices, may it please the Court, I'm Rodney Sumter, the attorney for the respondent for the last 17 years. He's here today and seated in the courtroom because of the gravity of the Court's determinations that could result from this case. I frame this as a matter as we submit that appellant's appeal and the issues identified by them are simply without merit. For the past 20 years, since the termination of the party's community in September of 1994, and 19 years since Judge Jordan divided the community property, the appellant has continued in her quest to obtain benefits that she would otherwise not be entitled to, a legal and factual determination that was supported by the sound discretion of the trial court. This matter is not here for the implementation of justice, but is here fueled by appellant's anger, grief, and malice, which has plagued these parties for over a third of their adult lives. Acts that have been perpetrated by the appellant have brought us here today. Today we ask the court to affirm the ruling and orders of the Honorable Judge Peck and put this matter to rest. Identified by this court are really three issues that I understand the court would like to hear about. The first one is did the district court have jurisdiction to grant Howard's motion to modify the quadro? The simple answer is absolutely yes. The appellant's own document, which was prepared and submitted to Judge Jordan without any notice to my client, signed and then presented to PERS, contains, in paragraph 11, the retention of jurisdiction statements. That's real important because that is exactly what the Gemma case provides for. In a situation as this, where Dr. Henson was early in his career with the state of Nevada and his contributions to the PERS system, we had to wait and see what would happen over the course of that career, which, as it turned out, added an additional total of 20 service credit years to his coffer of pension benefits. So it is absolutely appropriate for the district court to review that quadro, which was presented in terms of the Gemma decision. So that brings us to the various methods that the court could do that. The first one is exactly what Dr. Henson did. We brought a motion at the appropriate time before the court to interpret the provisions of that quadro, which, as aside to that, we do claim was void or voidable because of the lack of notice on that preparation and presentation to the court and to PERS. So it was entirely, though, appropriate under Gamma for that to be done when it was done. Now, the other way to do that and get it back before the court would have been by appellant to have brought her own motion if she elected to receive benefits, which she did not do, and there was no determination based upon that type of request. The third method would have been, upon Dr. Henson's retirement and to attain benefits, the court would need to review it because of the substantial effort under the Gamma provisions that Dr. Henson had and that did affect the ultimate division of that pension award. Now, that segues then into whether or not the district court erred in denying Kristen Henson's motion for a judgment. You know, when we look at and read, our argument is that she never asked, and she never did. The record in this case is completely devoid, despite the fact that Kristen Henson was represented by competent counsel, various counsel, at every stage along the way. She never made a request to Dr. Henson, either personally or through her counsel, hey, I want my benefits now. What do we do when we have a situation like that? We have to look at what Gemma says. And Gemma is very clear. In that case, the non-participant employee, this court said, may elect to receive pension benefits at the time they become due. That puts the onus on Kristen Henson to make that demand. And what the district court found was that not only did she not do that, she rested on her laurels for a period of many years, 7-8 years, and then all of a sudden, when the motion that we filed to review the quadro is presented, she files her motion under ostensibly under CERTIC, requesting a huge amount of money. Fair? I say not. To send that message that a participant can simply sit by for 7 or 8 years waiting for someone potentially to retire and then upon retirement say, oh, by the way, you owe me $100,000 is not and cannot be the decision of this court. It is inequitable. It's unjust. It provides a way for the doctrine of latches to be adopted by this court as the rule of law. We don't care how long you wait to do that.
Now, Mr. Sumter, yes. Did Dr. Henson retire under option two?
Dr. Henson, and to address the court's questions, Dr. Henson is now retired from the system. A modified quadro was entered by the district court, and Kristen Henson has been, we believe, receiving her benefits since November of last year. He did retire under option two, naming his present wife, Mimi Henson, to whom he's been married to for a substantial amount of time, as the survivor beneficiary.
Okay.
And that brings me to the next very serious issue that we have. Appellant would have us believe that even though there is no language in the decision of Judge Jordan back in 1995, that Kristen Henson is able to name herself as the survivor beneficiary. A review of that decision and order will show this court there is no language at all that would say that. It says, however, that the community property pension is divided equally, and it is valued at $53,800 and some dollars, but because there's no money to pay that out, which is what Fondi says, we're going to wait and see what ultimately happens. Judge Jordan did it right. There's nothing that we could have done. What did happen, though, is that these parties had another dispute, which was resolved by a settlement agreement with this court that was approved. And not more than a month after that was done, Kristen Henson presented her quadro to Judge Jordan for execution 4 years after the decision. Your Honor, you stated that, is that the normal? No, it's not the normal. But what is the normal as a practitioner in this area? First of all, typically, we send those out because they're very complicated. You do many, many drafts, and it's better if somebody who is a preparer does that because they're independent. In this case, not only was a preparer not hired, Kristen Henson's own counsel prepared it, named her as the survivor beneficiary, and then submitted it to the judge. No notice that it was ever done. There was no notice of entry of that quadro before the court. And it was sent over to PERS. Well, PERS, if it looks like a quadro, then it must be a quadro. They don't look at the decision. They don't know whether or not it's correct. They're just doing a ministerial act as they're prescribed to do by law. What that did do by her doing that, and this was intentional, because at the time this was done, the facts were out that Dr. Henson was of ill health. He has a heart condition. That's part of the record. He was placing her bets that Dr. Henson would die, that the pension would go into effect, and that she would receive the totality of the benefits Dr. Henson had.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the PERS law required that if a PERS retiree is married, that the spouse, the current spouse, as of before retirement, has to sign a consent form to which option you exercise? Is that correct?
That's true, Your Honor, because your second question to Mr. Torvinen, even though there's a quadro, my client, as the participant, has to sign a form designating, and that also is typically signed by the spouse.
The current spouse.
The current spouse. So because all of these things were done, and that is why this took so long, is because PERS had made some errors on their benefits calculation, as Mr. Torvinen said, and it took my client, working with PERS, over 7 years to have that corrected. From the 10.3 years of service to the correct amount of 5.3 at the time of the termination of the community. Now,
the other question I have is on the quadros. Again, it's been a lot of years since I practiced, and I did very little in this area, but my recollection was you submit the quadro simultaneous with the decree, which was the general practice, I guess, in Clark County, how it was done. Now, assuming it can be done afterwards, which the parties acknowledge it can, does it have to be served upon opposing counsel an opportunity to review and all before it's submitted to the district court?
Your Honor, it's our submission to this court that a finding has to be made that that must be done. I have never done a quadro where both parties haven't participated and, in fact, haven't signed off at the bottom to say, yes, this is approved by each of us. And now, for a lot of employers, not sure about PERS, but they require that. They require a designation that each party has agreed to this because they don't want this very problem coming back at them. The issue of the evidentiary hearing is very troublesome. You know, if we take the discretion from our district court judges to decide matters on their pleadings where it's not required as a matter of law to have a hearing, what are we doing? In this case, if we look at the record, Judge Peck had volumes of briefs, affidavits, and documents as evidence, all of which had been addressed by both of the parties. She had a full and comprehensive view. I submit that the citation of issues in appellant's brief are non-issues because they are either not issues or were resolved by the facts that were presented in the case. I'm not going to go through that because of the length of time, but what I do want to say is that if this court requires on every motion, which is what a decision could read, on every motion that a district court judge is required to have an evidentiary hearing when it's not otherwise required as a matter of law, such as in Rooney for child custody cases, which we all understand, what is that going to cause? It's going to cause a substantial detriment, financially, time, and otherwise, to the court system. And this court system is concerned about that, because of our quest for an intermediary appellate court, to require our district court judges to have a hearing when they shouldn't have to in their own mind, they see this is where it should be, would create such a horrible backlog in the courts as to be insurmountable. And as we all know, justice delayed is justice denied, and that's exactly what would happen here. Judge Peck, you can see by her order, was so thoughtful, and she spent the time and effort to, in her findings of fact, to address everything that had, was raised by the appellant substantively as matters of error. We have to leave our district judges with those types of discretion. Otherwise, we're going to create a huge, huge problem in this state, and we can't send that message. So again, I'd like to reiterate that appellant had the affirmative obligation, in order to receive any benefits, to make an election, which she failed to do. She can't go back now, 7, 8 years later, and say, I didn't do anything, but I demand $100,000 from you. That result sends yet another horrible message. It sends out that anybody in the future, in any case and facts, can just sit and wait and then financially destroy the other party at some point along the line by saying, you owe me all this money. This isn't child support. This is a pension. And the law, the case law says that you have that responsibility to make that election. And that was not ever done in this case. Your Honors, I appreciate being able to discuss this matter with you. I appreciate the en banc presentation. I know that means that you're very serious about this case, and we have enjoyed appearing here today.
Thank you, Mr. Sumter, and thank you, Mr. Trevian, for your excellent arguments and briefs. Just a couple points. Mr. Sumter, I just wanted to correct one thing, nothing to do with the case. You mentioned the Intermediate Court of Appeals. It won't be intermediate. It's just a Court of Appeals, which will be a division between the current cases. So I know you're talking to your clients and all about it, and that's the difference.
Right, and Justice Hart says at a luncheon, one of the reasons why he probably recused himself, because 3 weeks ago we were at a luncheon sitting next to each other, and when he was making a presentation to the bankruptcy bar about this very issue, and believe me, we're all behind it in the bar, so we'll do everything we can.
That we appreciate both of you and all your contributions and all to the family bar, and so we will take this case under submission, and we'll be in recess for about a minute or so.